Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York today. The official beginning of the next chapter in the legal standoff between the January 6th committee and those protecting the disgraced, twice-impeached ex-president Donald J. Trump. The January 6th committee, putting its money where its mouth is, expected to vote in a matter of hours to recommend contempt charges for key Trump ally, one Steve Bannon. Bannon is defying a subpoena to turn over documents and to appear for testimony, citing Donald Trump's spurious previous claims of executive privilege. In taking action today, the committee is making good on its vow to ensure that no one, not even an ex-president, claiming executive privilege is above the law. Following the committee's vote, a vote will be put to the full House floor to refer Steve Bannon to the Justice Department for criminal contempt. And though President Joe Biden himself has signaled his full support for prosecution of Steve Bannon, the Justice Department will then have discretion over what happens next and how Steve Bannon will be held accountable for refusing to cooperate with a congressional investigation. Overnight, the January 6th committee put out a report detailing the legal case against Steve Bannon and underscoring his role in the events leading up to the January 6th insurrection. From that report, quote, in short, Bannon appears to have played a multifaceted role in the events of January 6th. And the American people are entitled to hear his firsthand testimony regarding his actions. The Select Committee expects that such testimony will be directly relevant to its report and its recommendations for legislative and other action. They add that Mr. Bannon's purported basis for noncompliance is wholly without merit, and that on any claims of executive privilege, quote, Bannon was a private citizen during the relevant time period, and the testimony and documents the Select Committee is demanding do not concern discussion of official government matters with the president and his immediate advisors. The law is clear. Executive privilege does not extend to discussions between the president and private citizens relating to non-governmental business or among private citizens. On that point, legal experts are today weighing in, including one very conservative attorney whose name may sound familiar. He specializes in immunity claims, Chuck Cooper. He told The Washington Post this, quote, Bannon cannot legally defend defiance of a subpoena. The overarching point is that the president's immunity from congressional subpoena extends only to his closest Oval Office advisors. Bannon clearly did not qualify at the time of his communications with President Trump about the election. Post also cites attorneys who take the opposing view, but Cooper's take is particularly noteworthy because he represented John Bolton in his subpoena fight during the Ukraine scandal in 2019, which of course led to the president's first impeachment. But beyond the legal case the January 6th committee is making, last night's report also provides details on the specific communications the committee is seeking and looking at from Bannon, offering something of a roadmap of the case they're building against him. The request includes documents related to a January 5th meeting with members of Congress at the Willard Hotel, financing and fundraising to assist with anyone's travel to the January 6th rally. The organization known as March for Trump and its activities related to January 6th and, quote, anyone with whom he communicated with respect to efforts, plans or proposals to contest the 2020 presidential election results or delay, influence or impede the electoral count. The case taking shape against Steve Bannon and what he could offer the committee on Donald Trump is where we start today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Yumi Shalcinder is here, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour and the moderator of Washington Week. Also joining us, Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney, now a law professor at the University of Alabama. And Betsy Woodruff Swan is here, Politico national correspondent. Fortunately for us, all three of them are MSNBC contributors. Betsy, let me start with you and the case against Steve Bannon. What does Steve Bannon know?
Bannon, for instance, on January 5th, knew that January 6th was going to be one of the most historic days in the history of this country. He said that publicly on his podcast. He said that things were going to get crazy and wild on January 6th. He's since tried to reinterpret those comments and suggest that they were about something other than chaos unfolding. But it's clear that in the days and hours leading up to the attack on the Capitol, Bannon knew enough about what was going on that he gave, startlingly, one of the most accurate predictions of how the chaos that day would play out. It would be nuts if the congressional committee didn't want to drill down and get as much information from him as possible about his involvement, his visibility, the members of Congress he was speaking to, the financial efforts to bring people into Washington, D.C. on January 5th, January 6th. And I think one of the biggest questions is, what did they think was going to happen?
Well, I want to read, Yamiche, what Betsy's describing. I'm of two minds about playing it. I decided not to do that today, but I will read it because this is it verbatim. Quote, "All hell is going to break loose tomorrow," Bannon told listeners of his radio show. Quote, "It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen, okay? It's going to be quite extraordinarily different. All I can say is strap in. You made this happen, and tomorrow it's game day, so strap in. Let's get ready. Man, if I was in a revolution, I would be in Washington. Well, this is your time in history, and it's all converging, and now we're on the point of attack tomorrow." Yamiche, Steve Bannon knew exactly what was going to happen because Steve Bannon was the one amplifying the insider in chief in calling for this delay. We know who wrote the memo. John Eastman wrote the memo. We know what Mike Pence was supposed to do before it was sort of blown up that Pence would carry out the coup plot the way Eastman had mapped it out in his plan. And we know exactly what Steve Bannon had summoned Donald Trump supporters to do. What does a rewrite of that even look like, Yamiche?
Well, Nicole, it's sort of remarkable to go back and read Steve Bannon's words, knowing that he is the architect, a chief co-conspirator of the grievance politics that former President Trump, that he was going after for so long, for so many years. He was the person who was behind this idea of rallying people up through Breitbart and then through being a chief strategist for President Trump. So they understood that they were sort of gearing people up, angering people, feeding people these lies. And when you listen to what he's talking about on January 6th and what he's previewing for people on January 6th, it's that all hell is going to break loose. So it is, of course, as Betsy said, it makes sense that the committee wants to know exactly who Steve Bannon was talking to, and lawmakers in their letters to Steve Bannon say that he played a quote multifaceted role in January 6th. So right now the question is, what is going to be the end game here? We have the former president suing, trying to stop documents from being released. We have the Biden White House saying that at least for these initial documents, for the requests that have gone out, there is no executive privilege. That assertion lies plainly in the hands of President Biden, and he is saying that this day was so extraordinary that that is being waived in order for lawmakers to get to the bottom of this. So what you really have here is Steve Bannon and former President Trump trying to delay what is going to be inevitable, which is at some point we are going to find out more details about exactly how January 6th happened.
And Joyce, we included the reporting in the Washington Post about Chuck Cooper. Chuck Cooper, a conservative, and important to this story, really the architect of the legal framework that kept John Bolton out of the impeachment investigation in the House and trial in the Senate during Donald Trump's first impeachment. That architect of keeping John Bolton from having to testify is saying that Steve Bannon has no such case to make not to testify.
Well, Allison, I have to tell you, about a month ago,
you know, when you've lost Chuck Cooper, who also represented former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, you're in really, really big trouble in this area. And it demonstrates how very weak the arguments for executive privilege are in this case. Bannon wasn't in the White House. Executive privilege doesn't really apply, not even arguably. But something we need to be aware of here is that Congress has imperfect mechanisms for enforcing their subpoena, and they have no guarantee that they can obtain Bannon's testimony. They can enforce civilly. They can prosecute criminally if DOJ will intervene. That might mean that Bannon goes to prison for a brief period of time. It doesn't mean that he'll end up testifying. And so Yamiche makes a really good point. She talks about Bannon as the architect of Trump's grievance politics. what we have to be prepared for if we believe it's important for Congress to enforce these subpoenas. And I believe that it is incredibly important here. If you can't enforce the subpoena against Bannon, Congress might as well pack up and quit having any pretense of oversight ability. But what we have to be really aware of is the risk that Bannon will wrap himself in that mantle of witch hunt and of being politically persecuted, and that they will try to use this to whip Trump's base back into a fever. Everyone needs to be prepared for that scenario.
Well, I mean, I guess if he was really down with going to jail and making a point, he wouldn't have begged for a pardon in the final days. But we'll let Bannon address that. Betsy, the committee's naming names. I mean, it's not just Steve Bannon. He didn't meet at the Willard to plot the coup by himself. He met with, well, I'll read from the report. Public reporting also suggests that Bannon was among several prominent supporters of efforts to undermine the election results who gathered at the Willard Hotel, two blocks from the White House on the days surrounding the January 6th attack. The group that assembled at the Willard is reported to have included members of the Trump campaign's legal team, including Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman, several prominent proponents of false election fraud claims that had been promoted by Trump. Boris Epstein was there, Russell Ramsland, as well as Roger Stone, who left the hotel with Oath Keeper bodyguards, and campaign spokesman Jason Miller. Someone will be unwilling to go to jail for Donald Trump. Someone will testify to this committee about where this plan took shape and Donald Trump's role in it. That, as Bob Weber says, the truth emerges. Do you have any sense of where these other individuals stand and how far they're willing to go?
It's not clear, and particularly many of these folks who were at the Willard that day are also part of very much Trump's inner circle, people who are closest to him, people whose, you might say, livelihoods are connected to being part of Trump's propagating the big lie. They're totally all the way in. That said, if you're able to get inside this room at the Willard, undoubtedly, it would be a treasure trove of information for the Select Committee. One person who has drawn some attention and who I expect may draw more attention going forward is Boris Epstein. He's been connected to Trump world deeply for quite a long time. One of the lawyers who is in the room for many of these conversations, you haven't heard his name a ton in the mix as part of this probe, but I think there's a decent chance that will change going forward. Of course, Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman are very much two marquee names in this process. Eastman was very much the intellectual, quote unquote, heft behind the effort to pressure Mike Pence to overturn the election. Very much a key player and somebody who's been a key player in all sorts of far-fetched conservative legal strategies to try to change the outcome of Democratic elections in this country. So there's no question he's also going to be a central point for the Select Committee. One thing that's really important to keep an eye on is what Kash Patel and Mark Meadows do as they continue to be in talks with the Select Committee, though. If Meadows and Patel, both of whom were also very much Trump insiders, decide that they're going to play ball with the committee and follow through on some of these discussions that they're having, then that will send an important signal to other witnesses that, hey, maybe we're not all standing together. Maybe there are some penguins jumping off the iceberg, and it's not the worst thing in the world to cooperate with this committee. And it certainly is preferable to going to prison. So those two folks are key figures to keep an eye on in the coming year too.
There's that. Yamiche, let me just poke a little puncture wound in this idea that they're on the Trump money train. I mean, there isn't a money train. There isn't a train and there isn't any money on it. Trump doesn't pay his lawyers, and he's in real legal peril, in real trials, in real courtrooms, giving real depositions that'll be heard by real jurors. He doesn't pay them. So the notion that there's some financial, professional, long-term play by committing criminal contempt of Congress is a little foolish. Where do you put sort of this cast of characters and the odds that they will defy these subpoenas?
Well, what's always been the biggest question, Nicole, in the way that you just laid it out, this idea that loyalty to President Trump, the consequences of that, the benefits of that are still sort of up in the air, a big question mark. But what you see here are a group of men, a group of people who have sort of surrounded President Trump and who have given him this sort of loyalty that President Trump has never given anyone else. We've seen him turn on so many different people. We've seen people close to him go to jail. But it seems as though in talking to people that are close to President Trump and his allies, they have this sort of greater idea that they will have this power within the GOP. Maybe it's to make money as consultants. Maybe it's to have some sort of power in running for office. The long-term goals of these people, I think, are really a big question mark here. What is clear is that there aren't the sort of cracks that we're seeing yet. You see Mark Meadows and Cash Patel being reportedly engaged with the committee, but we don't really know what that actually means. We don't know if that means that they're actually going to be giving up goods, giving up documents, giving up critical information about what former President Trump was doing on January 6th. What sort of conversations was he having? We have some reporting that he was boasting about the crowd size. I've been reporting for months that he was sort of enjoying this at some parts of this attack on the Capitol. All that being said, it really does take just a few people to really start to break this open in terms of what the real strategy was behind having this sort of insurrection happen. So all you need is a few people, but whether or not that will actually be there is a big question. And obviously lawmakers are trying their best to get some of these people in the Trump orbit to turn on him.
Joyce, I have sort of a two-part question. I mean, one, so much of this happened at public events. Donald Trump told the insurrectionists that he was going to walk with them down to the Capitol. We know that Donald Trump told Mike Pence to do the right thing. Donald Trump pressured Mike Pence not to count the votes at a Georgia rally, I think 2 days before January 6th. Donald Trump committed his attempt to overturn the election result in public, on recorded phone lines, on calls for which there were notes taken. And Bannon seems to be very unwilling to have this contempt vote go down. I just want to share with our viewers the latest developments. Bannon's attorney requested a delay of tonight's meeting and tonight's vote, citing Trump's lawsuit against the committee. The committee responded that because Trump's lawsuit is related to an archives request and not to Bannon's testimony, they would deny that. The White House has also weighed in to Bannon's attorney today, saying this: as you are aware, Bannon's tenure as a White House employee ended in 2017. To the extent any privileges could apply to Bannon's conversations with the former president or White House staff after the conclusion of his tenure, President Biden has already determined that an assertion of executive privilege is not in the public interest and therefore is not justified with respect to certain subjects within the purview of the Select Committee. President Biden's determination that an assertion of privilege is not justified applies to your client's deposition testimony and to any documents your client may possess concerning either subject. The White House seems to be saying, Joyce, and correct me if I'm wrong, executive privilege isn't a thing for Steve Bannon, who's now a podcaster, but the insurrection is so serious that we wouldn't honor it, even if it might be. Is that where they're heading?
I think that that's absolutely correct. They're making the point that executive privilege doesn't exist, and it's game over there. That's really all that they need to say. But they're taking this second step, this theme we've heard before, that the insurrection is such a standout event in American history that Congress is obligated to engage in its oversight function. And that's an important thing for the Biden White House to say, because it's not an individual sitting president who owns this notion that we have of executive privilege. It's the presidency itself, and it's the White House counsel that often drives these conversations to ensure that not only this president and past president, but future presidents too, will be able to obtain candid, honest advice from their advisors without fear that their words will be released and taken out of context or otherwise put on display. So the White House really guards executive privilege very jealously. It's important to note that insurrections, as you and I might think, are so very important that even the White House, the presidency, concedes that facts concerning insurrections belong to the public.
Well, and I guess, Betsy Woodruff, I'm thinking of the ex-president, Donald Trump's most senior lawyers, in their own words. I'm thinking of Pat Cipollone, as quoted by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, saying that he was expecting the president to be arrested on the day of 1-6. I'm thinking of the acting attorney general, Mr. Rosen, who has now willingly and voluntarily testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think for more than 8 hours, at least one time, and before the 1-6 committee, describing not just a coup plot, but a conspiracy involving Republican members of Congress. Donald Trump's closest legal advisors knew that something illegal and untoward was going on, and they have already talked to Congress.
Yeah, that's right. The fact that so many senior administration officials that late in the administration were appalled by what they saw Trump doing at the Justice Department tells you just how wild that episode was. At this point in Trump's administration, he and some of his lackeys had engaged in elaborate efforts to try to purge anyone from the administration who they deemed as disloyal. Remember, Jeff Sessions, Trump removed him from the Justice Department. He sort of exited humiliated because he wasn't entirely loyal to Trump in a deeply servile way. And because of that, because Sessions wasn't so deeply loyal to Trump, his political career was ended. He was not able to get reelected as Senate back in Alabama. Trump very much made an example of Sessions punishing him for the fact that he just deferred to basic ethics guidance. That punishment and those consequences that Sessions faced absolutely send a warning sign to the folks now who are trying to connect themselves to Trump going forward. But of course, this committee has real leverage. It has the ability to bring people in. It has a lot of influence. And so what that means going forward is that we expect them to be able to get testimony likely from other Trump lawyers. The fact that there was really only one senior DOJ official who was a handmaiden to Trump's efforts to turn the Justice Department upside down tells you how wild it was. It tells you that even when you took sort of the last guard standing around Trump to his very final days at a point when many administration officials had already left, even when you took that last core of basically Trump bitter edgers, even among that group, there was really only one Justice Department lawyer who was standing by Trump. It's extraordinary. And for the country, it's lucky.
You, Michelle Sinder, Betsy Widderswan, thank you so much for starting us off on this news today. Joyce is sticking around. When we come back, prosecuting the insurrectionists, how the FBI interview of one Trump supporter who attacked Officer Michael Fanone can help us understand how the big lie and the Republican Party that supported it has led to the torment of so many of these defendants. Plus, the DOJ asking the United States Supreme Court to move quickly on blocking the Texas near-complete ban on abortions. The court has denied that request once. What happens if they do it again? How the role of the Supreme Court is changing before our very eyes. And we'll ask if enough is being done about that. It's coming up. And later in the program, as we march toward tonight's vote against Steve Bannon, we'll look at the seriousness of a new White House and a new Justice Department, ones that believe no one should be above the law. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
At one point, I came face to face with an attacker who repeatedly lunged for me and attempted to remove my firearm. I heard chanting from some in the crowd, "Get his gun and kill him with his own gun." I was aware enough to recognize I was at risk of being stripped of and killed with my own firearm. I was electrocuted again and again and again with a taser. I'm sure I was screaming, but I don't think I could even hear my own voice.
That was Officer Michael Fanone. That was his testimony to the January 6th Select Committee about his harrowing battle with the mob of insurrectionists, Trump supporters, who stormed the Capitol that day. More than 10 months after the January 6th attack, the Department of Justice is prosecuting more than 600 people for their role in carrying out the insurrection. Among them, one of the men who allegedly attacked Michael Fanone that day, a man named Daniel Rodriguez. Daniel Rodriguez tells the FBI that he regrets his actions at the Capitol. He says he was radicalized by right-wing media and duped into believing the election was stolen from Donald Trump. A transcript of his interview with the FBI shows him saying, quote, "I'm so stupid. I thought I was going to be awesome. I thought I was a good guy. My story is just that we thought that we were going to save America, and we were wrong." The Chicago Tribune columnist points out the devastating effect of the big lie on not just the insurrectionists like Rodriguez, but on countless other Americans. They write this, quote, "You need only scan social media a few moments to see how these lies do the same for so many. And on Fox News and on InfoWars and in the Facebook feeds of conspiracy profiteers and in the words of tweets and many gutless elected Republicans, you see those lies still tossed out like chum. It's unconscionable what these people are doing to Americans they know will be susceptible to such lies. Their words are turning citizen against citizen and warping minds for nothing but money and power." Joining our conversation is Ryan Riley, HuffPost senior justice reporter. Joyce Vance is still with us. Ryan, it is hard to feel sorry for someone who electrocuted Michael Fanone, allegedly, again and again. And again, in Michael Fanone's words, but if we're going to deal with the radicalization of our fellow citizens by Fox News and Facebook and Donald Trump and every single silent complicit Republican, which is all of them, except for Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, I guess a little bit of sympathy or empathy is as good a place to start as any.
Yeah, I mean, you sort of see him get sucked away, and he goes through some of the things he's gone through in his life. He was homeless at one point, but you really see, I think, the core of this is that this is why this is so frightening and so scary to have these sort of ludicrous conspiracy theories floating out there, because some people are actually going to believe them. Millions of people actually believe them, but some of those millions of people are actually going to do something about it and engage in the kind of violence that Danny Rodriguez did. You know, I think that it's really interesting to look at how the FBI conducted this interview. It's a really skillful interview and basically how they basically got on his side. Essentially what they did, you know, we had reported on Danny Rodriguez's identity in February, built upon the work that some online sleuths and some anti-fascist activists who knew him from California who were able to identify him. So a month later, when the FBI arrests him, they approached him with this information and said essentially that, you know, basically that Antifa, the Black Lives Matter, and the Huffington Post were forming the narrative about Danny Rodriguez and that they could help him get the narrative out there. And he sort of, you know, it worked. He basically spilled his guts, told his story, broke down in tears several times, and explained what exactly happened and admitted to tasing Officer Fanone. I mean, it was clear as day on video, so there wasn't much of an argument he could really make there. But it really was this sort of view inside the mind of someone who had been sucked in by these conspiracy theories and shows the core danger of these conspiracy theories floating out there in the world.
Joyce, I guess my question for you is, as a prosecutor, when do you feel like saying I'm so stupid is a matter of seeking leniency? And when is someone actually crying out for help and saying, yes, I've been duped by Fox News?
Something that you always have to remember as a prosecutor is that the people you're prosecuting aren't just statistics. They're human beings with families and with backstories. And we have every reason in our system to do more than just to exact a harsh, demanding sort of a justice. But also there's this notion that the law is entitled to exact consequences for criminal conduct. And the way we deal with people who are truly, truly sorry for what they've done, who come forward and plead guilty, and who perhaps cooperate in other cases, is that they're given credit at sentencing. They're given, by under the sentencing guidelines, a reduction in the sentence that they face. And that really, in many cases, is a significant benefit that they get over people who insist on going forward. I think you're sort of asking a larger question here, though, Nicole, is what do we do in this setting where we see people like this being prosecuted and we don't see the people who brought them to this point being prosecuted or at least held accountable? No accountability for Facebook, no accountability for Fox News, no accountability for Trump. That's what we're really going to need if we're ever going to get closure on this situation and, more importantly, find a way to move past it as a country.
Yeah, and I mean, Ryan, I want to read more from this interview because you're right. It is a skillful questioning. Quote, "I thought that Trump was going to stay president and they were going to find all this crooked stuff. We thought we were part of a bigger thing. We thought we were being used as part of a plan to save the country, to save America, to save the Constitution and the election and the integrity." Steve Bannon on January 6th said many of those things, too. the Daniel Rodriguez's of the world. If you wanted to be part of a revolution, go to Washington tomorrow. It's all happening tomorrow. So how do these individuals blame the president and his inside circle for sending them or making them believe that?
Yeah, you know, at one point they sort of asked him, you know, did Trump put the taser in your hand? And, you know, no, I think that there's still some loyalty there amongst a lot of these people. Danny Rodriguez talked about how he felt like he knew Donald Trump from The Apprentice and watching him on television, and really thought that he was a part of this broader movement. He actually tried to join the military after Donald Trump became president, but was rejected. He was 35 at that point and had a little bit of a criminal record. So it wasn't something that was an easy entry for him into the military. But I mean, that's sort of how dedicated he was to this movement. He was on television. He was at Trump rallies and appearing on local news and getting into fights with anti-Trump protesters. I mean, this was a guy who really thought he found a cause and dedication. And we've seen this in so many instances before. You know, I think back to this this trial I covered in Kansas, where three Trump fans plotted in 2016, during the 2016 election, to slaughter Muslim refugees. You look back to the individual who mailed pipe bombs to all of Trump's enemies across the country. There's this real thorough through of all of these individuals who think that they're patriots and think that they're acting on behalf of Donald Trump and think that, you know, they're targeting the right people here and are part of this broader movement in support of this one individual.
And then they realize they're just felons. Let me show you, Joyce Vance, a clip from the HBO documentary. This is Congressman Ruben Gallego talking about fighting the mob. Watch.
I was an infantryman in the United States Marine Corps. I had to deal with some very aggressive crowds when I was in Iraq. Individuals themselves aren't usually a problem. But when they get collectively together and they create a mob, the mob is the weapon. I was ready to fight. I saw a lot of shit back in my day, but I was not going to die on the floor of the House of Representatives. Like, I was not going to get taken out by some insurrectionist.
I hope you go and watch it, because for the full effect, you need everything that was beeped. But it's important to remember what we thought was possible that day. And I covered it live. I'll never forget covering it live. And thank God nobody was hurt. Thank God no Republican member of Congress. Thank God Mike Pence wasn't hurt. Thank God no Democratic member of Congress wasn't hurt or killed that day. But it was not a sure thing that no one would be hurt. And this veteran, Congressman Gallego, said, "I was ready to fight. I saw a lot of bleep back in my day, but I was not going to die on the floor of the bleeping House of Representatives." Joyce, how do you keep the horror of that day front and center and move toward accountability for institutions like Facebook and people like Donald Trump and Steve Bannon?
That's perhaps the biggest problem that we're facing right now. We're not even a year out, and somehow the events of January 6th, which, like you, I remember in such blazing detail, it's almost like having post-traumatic stress seeing pictures. And, you know, I was thousands of miles away at the time. It seems like it should be a moment in our cultural history like 9/11 that's emblazoned in everyone's memory. And somehow Trump and his folks, or maybe just time and other events like the pandemic, have led it to recede from our memory. So I think that's one of the reasons this committee's work is so very important. Having public testimony could be very important. Bringing a narrative to the public could be very important. But to go back to Ryan's reporting, it's very interesting to me that the defendant, in the case that he talks about, his lawyers have suggested he will use a defense called public authority. And what that defense boils down to is he will say that he was acting when he was part of that mob that stormed the Capitol on former President Trump's orders. Public authority is a very limited sort of defense. The reason that we know that he'll use it is because you're required by the rules to advise prosecutors of that early. And it's used in cases, for instance, maybe you're working with the CIA and the CIA asks you to do something that's technically illegal and you're arrested. And as a defense to your conduct, you say, listen, I was working undercover. I was helping the CIA. So I shouldn't be held criminally accountable. And that's what we're going to see in that case, that defense of public authority. And depending on the facts or the sort of arguments that are presented by the defense lawyers, this could be the responsibility of Trump as magnified by platforms like Facebook and conservative news media that put his message out in a way that will finally help us really understand January 6th and put it in the context of the president's responsibility for those events.
Brian Riley, thank you for joining us with your reporting on this. Joyce is sticking around. The Biden administration giving the Supreme Court another opportunity to reconsider allowing Texas's draconian near total ban on abortions go into effect there. Talk about that story next. The Justice Department is asking the Supreme Court to act now to block Texas's near total ban on abortions. Writing in a new brief, quote, SB 8 has made abortion effectively unavailable in Texas after roughly 6 weeks of pregnancy. Texas has, in short, successfully nullified this court's decisions within its borders. Allowing SB 8 to remain in force would perpetuate the ongoing irreparable injury to the thousands of Texas women who are being denied their constitutional rights. This is the second time that the Supreme Court has been asked to block the law from taking effect. Justice Alito asking Texas officials to file their response by noon Thursday, a sign that the court intends to act quickly. Given, however, that the court declined to block the law just 1 month ago, it is unlikely that the court's decision would be different this time, which would not only deny women access to vitally important health care, but could fundamentally reshape the role of the United States Supreme Court in American life in states from coast to coast. Joining our coverage, Donnie Deutsch, host of the podcast On Brand, also Nick Confessori, New York Times political and investigative reporter, and an MSNBC political analyst. Joyce Vance is still here. Joyce, help me understand this legal move, and then we'll get into sort of the politics and the ramifications.
Sure. So what's being litigated here is still not the substantive merits of whether SB 8 is constitutional. This is still preliminary skirmishing over whether or not the law should be enjoined while that litigation goes on. So as you point out, the first time SB 8 reached the Supreme Court late at night on their shadow docket, they said, we're going to permit this law to stay in effect because Texas is using this perplexing situation involving vigilante justice to enforce the law. And there's no one that we, the Supreme Court, have the power to enjoin. As you and I have discussed, Nicole, that's a silly, disingenuous argument. But DOJ comes back, and this is what's different about this new request the Supreme Court is looking at. DOJ says, okay, Supreme Court, we'll spot you the first case. But we have the ability, unlike the private plaintiffs in that first case, to directly sue the state of Texas. Texas has no legal immunity like they might have in some other cases. We're asking you to enjoin the state of Texas. You have the power to do that. And unless there's a different jurisprudence that applies to abortion, if the same rules still apply, and if we're entitled to an injunction in a case where the law is clear, Roe versus Wade is still the law, and women are being irreparably injured if this statute gets to stay in effect, then you're obligated, court, to enjoin it while this litigation goes on. And that's exactly what we'll find out later this week, Nicole. Is the Supreme Court using a separate jurisprudence for abortion, or do we have one set of laws and procedures that applies to everything, no matter what the substantive nature of the lawsuit is?
Joyce, I want to turn to something I always try to do when we have these conversations, and that is the real world implication. The real world implication isn't the right word. The horror that is now the reality for women living in Texas, rape victims, victims of incest, girls for whom a pregnancy could kill them, and even maybe someone who has a miscarriage. Let me read this from the New York Times, Michelle Goldberg. Brittany Pula, then 19 years old, showed up at the Comanche County Memorial Hospital in Oklahoma last year after suffering a miscarriage at home. A medical examiner cited her drug use as one of several conditions contributing to the miscarriage, a list which also included congenital abnormality and placental abruption. Pula was arrested on a charge of manslaughter in the first degree. After deliberating for less than 3 hours, a jury found her guilty, and she was sentenced to 4 years in prison. Pula's case is an injustice, but it's also a warning.
This is what happens when the law treats embryos and fetuses as people with rights that supersede the rights of those people who carry them. And it offers a glimpse of the sort of prosecutions that could become common in a world in which Roe versus Wade is overturned, one we could be living in as soon as next year. I don't know that people understand this. Claire McCaskill has made this point on this program. IVF is something that could be called into question should Roe versus Wade be overturned. Miscarriages, which are a tragedy in every instance just about, could become a new war, a criminal war against women. Do you feel, Joyce, like people understand what's on the line, what's before the United States Supreme Court right now?
I think that they don't. And the primary horror of this, women who need or want abortions and who are unable to access them, that's horrific. These cases about younger women, these cases about people in difficult situations, victims of domestic violence, or women who don't feel prepared or ready to carry a pregnancy to term. There are a lot of complicated questions there that are, you know, in the Supreme Court's judgment, best left to a woman and her doctor to decide. But beyond that, this notion that women who do terminate a pregnancy, or worse still, women who suffer a miscarriage but have a vindictive person around them who alleges that it was not a miscarriage, that it was abortion, and are then subjected to criminal prosecution. Because if Roe versus Wade is reversed, whatever new standard the Supreme Court sets, we have fetuses who now carry the same rights as human beings, and they can be assaulted, they can be murdered, people can be prosecuted. The spillover impact of this decision is something people haven't even begun to contemplate yet.
Donnie, I want to turn to the politics of this. This is the Virginia governor's race, which is getting a lot of national attention. This is from some reporting in the Washington Post. Abortion is a major factor in 48% of Virginia voters' decisions about this election, according to a poll conducted earlier this month. Running behind vaccine mandates, how schools teach about race and history and taxes, the top three issues voters cited. Is that the right place for it?
Yeah, look, in a YouGov Economist poll, abortion basically spiked 11% for Democrats. I think it went up from 39 to 51. And abortion went down in importance to Republicans, 11 or 12% in the other directions. So you kind of see that playing out. I actually think that this issue, a woman's right, is, other than somebody's on a daily basis, how people vote, putting food on the table, is the one that triggers. It is the one. It's the one that symbolizes who we are as a society. Are we progressive or are we regressive? And I don't think it just touches women. I think it so trumps every other social issue and every other economic issue, really, at the end of the day. So I do think the only silver lining in this heinous parade that's going on, and I do think it's important to always talk about specifics, because when you hear the specifics, you hear the specific stories, you understand the severity and the obsceneness of what's going on. But the only silver lining is politically, it is a wedge for the Democrats to use. And I do think going forward, if this does stick in Texas, and obviously we see it coming in Mississippi and Arkansas, this is going to become a national issue and a real baton for the Democrats.
All right. No one's going anywhere. President Biden is working behind the scenes largely this afternoon to try to wrap up some lingering issues around his big and transformative agenda with members of his own party. He's got to do this before he again goes out to sell the whole plan to the public. We'll bring you the latest next.
I truly believe that if we work in good faith and we understand where we are today and where our country is and the needs we really have and then the aspirations that we have further down the road, let's do what we can do together. Let's get that piece of legislation agreed upon that we can start working the framework of that and putting it together.
Today, Joe Manchin, just one of the many Democrats President Biden is meeting with as he tries to rally his own party to come together and wrap up negotiations on his economic package ahead of their self-imposed Halloween deadline. Most notably, in addition to Manchin there, President Biden also met with Senator Kyrsten Sinema, both major holdouts on the bill in the Senate, while also meeting separately with a large number of lawmakers from the progressive and moderate wings of the party, attempting to come to an agreement on his signature economic bill that has plagued the first year of his presidency so far. Democratic leader Schumer says they're hopeful a framework can be reached this week. We're back with Donny Deutsch, Nick Confessori, and Joyce Vance. I mean, Nick, the White House will tell you that they're not mad at the progressive wing because they're trying to enact the president's agenda. They're not mad at the moderates because they need them at the end of the day. How do you put this together?
Well, the way is that everybody has to lose something. It's probably not going to be a $3.5 trillion Christmas tree. The political dilemma here is that Biden and his party are trying to stuff 4 years of pent up policy demands into one bill that can pass through reconciliation. It is extraordinarily hard. It's through the eye of a needle, and it's not clear that everyone can have what they want. So it's going to get a little worse and a little harder before it gets better for Democrats. And what these meetings are about is, okay, what's the most important and which things are going to be jettisoned so we can pass something? Because passing something is pretty important for Biden and for the House Democrats and the Senate Democrats. If they pass nothing, if this all ends in a heap, it's kind of the end and probably the last big chance they're going to have in this Congress to pass something, you know, huge and important.
You know, Donny, the edicts of sort of perfect being the enemy of good seems to apply here. As long as this White House can take something meaningful and the whole range of options is meaningful to people in their lives, it seems like a winner. But even the White House doesn't view it as a foregone conclusion that Democrats will come together and do what Nick just described. What do you think?
I believe they will. And I believe it's a little bit of a survivalist instinct in that really, if you're looking at the big prize or the big fear, it's 2024 and a new Trump presidency, a Trump presidency, whether it happens legally or illegally. And the Democrats fumble this ball. We're looking at the precipice of the end of our democracy. I'm not shrieking, howling at the moon. This is the reality, and it needs to be said every single day. So the Democrats have got to have their eye on that ball. I do believe it'll get settled. I do believe it'll be around $2 trillion. I think it's better than even if they pass the entire thing, because it doesn't give the Republicans kind of a socialistic club to hit the Democrats with and go, they've swung so far left, entitlements from cradle to grave. So I actually think this will end up okay for the Democrats.
Nick, you talked about the stakes for, you know, this White House and the legacy of the Biden presidency. The stakes are in some ways higher and more immediate for Congress. Talk about the pressures weighing on Speaker Pelosi and Chuck Schumer.
Look, this could be the last year of a Democratic House or Senate. And, you know, in this day and age with polarization so bad, essentially the first 2 years of a presidency of the same party are the big chance to get big things done. And all these pledges, all the discussions about the things Democrats could do if Trump was defeated and came into office, all these plans, all these ambitions are now coming down to this one bill. It's not the best circumstance. But again, if House Democrats are going to have, you know, the slightest chance of bucking history and holding on to the House, they have to have something significant and popular that they can show voters on the campaign trail. They have to have something.
And you're right. Making it popular is sometimes the work of the many, many months leading up to the midterms. Donny Deutsch, Nick Confessori, Joyce Vance, thank you all so much for spending some time with us today. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting started.
Well, he was in reportedly constant communication with Donald Trump in the days leading up to January 6th. In particular, the day before the insurrection, he forecast that all hell was going to break loose. So he has very plainly relevant testimony to our committee. It's also important, though, that the committee affirm the rule of law, that people, when they're subpoenaed, need to show up. And if they don't show up, they need to be prosecuted.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. Just a few hours from now, the January 6th Select Committee will send its biggest signal yet to Donald Trump and his allies. No one is above the law.
At 7:30 p.m. this evening, the committee will vote to refer former Trump senior advisor Steve Bannon for contempt of Congress after he did not comply with its subpoena. In what is expected to be a short meeting, the committee will vote on its report recommending Steve Bannon be held in criminal contempt following opening remarks by the chair and vice chair. With the resolution expected to pass, it will then head to the full House for a vote. As you heard from committee member Congressman Adam Schiff there, taking this step is crucial to the investigation. For one, because Steve Bannon, as the committee writes in its report, had, quote, specific knowledge about the events planned for January 6th before they occurred. And two, because the vote makes an example out of Bannon, an unwilling witness, signaling to other witnesses the committee wants to hear from. Don't comply with us, and you will face consequences. Here's a little more from Congressman Schiff on how the committee is not messing around.
The only thing I can say is that our patience is very short. We want cooperation. We're not going to allow ourselves to be endlessly strung along.
That steadfastness also exhibited when the committee put out a statement in response to the ex-president's lawsuit filed yesterday. Trump, of course, filed a suit against the committee in an attempt to block the handover of documents sought from the National Archives. This is the committee's response. Quote, the former president's clear objective is to stop the select committee from getting to the facts about January 6. His lawsuit is nothing more than an attempt to delay and obstruct our probe. It's hard to imagine a more compelling public interest than trying to get answers about an attack on our democracy and an attempt to overturn the results of an election. The attempts to delay and obstruct may have worked for the ex-president and his allies in the past, but now they're dealing with a new White House. Now they're dealing with a new Justice Department. The White House already roundly rejected Trump's attempt to assert executive privilege, and President Biden himself said that those who don't comply with the committee subpoenas should be prosecuted. The resounding message to Trump world, no one is above the law. And that is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Neil Katyal is here, a former acting U.S. Solicitor General, now a Georgetown law professor. Also joining us, former Republican Congressman David Jolly, the national chairman of the Serve America movement. And Jonathan Lemire is here, White House reporter for the Associated Press, all three MSNBC contributors. Neil Katyal, I start with you. Take me through the legal back and forth today. This feels like Trump world running the same play. Executive privilege for a podcast host who was nowhere near the West Wing for years and years and years before the insurrection, and the White House saying, no, that's not a thing.
Yeah, so this play has been run many times before. Trump has always lost the play. He's going to lose it again. So basically, the Congressional Committee is seeking all sorts of information about Steve Bannon and what he was up to in January 6th on the days before. Bannon says, no, I refuse. And so Congress is going to take this vote at 7:30 to hold him in contempt. Well, and it's an obvious vote. It's an easy vote. I don't think the outcome is in any doubt whatsoever. Liz Cheney and others have been telegraphing this for a long time, that people who stonewall the committee on something as important as January 6th will be held in contempt. So Bannon is saying, well, I have executive privilege over this information. And the problem with that is, first of all, Bannon wasn't even in the government during January 6th and all the events. So that's really hard. Bannon's like saying, well, Trump knows me, therefore executive privilege attaches. By that standard, then we might as well abolish congressional oversight, all 4,000 presidential appointees, just because at some point Trump had to read their names so he knows them. That's ludicrous. And then the other problem with this is that, you know, executive privilege is something that is generally held by the current president, not the former one. And Trump's kind of whole attempt here and going into court yesterday, filing a bogus lawsuit is like, you know, it's not plausible on its face. You know, he doesn't have the ability, you know, he has a very, very modest ability to invoke executive privilege as a former president. But when the current president says, the Supreme Court's basically said, we're going to defer to the current president. So this is going nowhere.
That's an important piece of analysis, that the Supreme Court has sided with the current president's sort of
prerogative on this. I want to read you some of the New York Times reporting on what is likely to ensue, Neil, and ask if you agree. The lawsuit, the Trump lawsuit, touches off what is likely to be a major legal battle between Trump and the House committee investigating the attack. Its outcome will carry consequences for how much the panel can uncover about Trump's role in the riot, pose thorny questions for the Biden administration, and potentially forge new precedents about presidential prerogatives and the separation of powers. Do you agree with that? And would you, I mean, it seems like one of the things, one of the many things that was so out of whack was that Congress had no authority. It was capable of almost no oversight. The impeachment witnesses, people like John Bolton, were not compelled to go. Don McGahn, the Mueller witness, they spent years in court trying to get him to testify. I think it was after President Biden's inauguration that he finally made his way to the Hill. Tell me about the stakes of this Trump lawsuit.
Yeah, I agree with that New York Times piece to a point. I think the problem with it is that it treats this like any other contempt dispute. And the fact is, it's not. I mean, we've certainly held people in contempt before and had litigation about that and litigation about executive privilege, but never on a matter as central to our democracy as this. And so I do think that, yes, maybe there are, you know, quote unquote, thorny legal problems in the sense that the courts haven't decided them before. But that's because no president before has decided to, a former president has tried to stonewall a congressional inquiry into something so serious. And so I actually think, you know, Trump, his delay is always his playbook. He's always trying to stretch things out. I think it's hard to delay this one too much just because the merits of the lawsuit are so weak. And the need for the evidence so compelling. And, you know, I just feel like, you know, this is Trump running into court trying to delay things. And it's like we're one lawsuit away from Donald Trump trying to argue that, you know, the Electoral College is unconstitutional because it has the power to elect a Democrat or something. I mean, you know, at some point, yes, though no court has ever decided that question before. But that's because it's a kind of joke question in the first place and shouldn't be asked, and certainly not by a former president of the United States.
Neil, I have one more for you on the judge who will hear this lawsuit. This is Kyle Cheney from Politico, who tweeted, good news for the January 6th committee. The Trump executive privilege lawsuit has been assigned to Judge Tanya Chutkan, who has expressed horror about the January 6th attack and extended sentences beyond what prosecutors have asked for in a couple cases. When she sentenced Matthew Mazzocco, she referenced Trump, quote, he went to the Capitol in support of one man, not in support of our country. Is that important?
Yes, I don't think so. I mean, Judge Chutkan's an excellent, excellent judge. And I think that's all you need is, frankly, any judge in this court, in the D.C. federal courthouse, could hear this case and throw this thing out easily. So, yeah, I guess it's good news in the sense that she's a judge. And that's all you really need to resolve this lawsuit.
You know, Jonathan, I want to bring you in on the White House posture on this. So the White House seems to be making two points. And Neil talks about one, the executive privilege, the bogus nature of Donald Trump exerting it, let alone Steve Bannon. But the other seems to be that the event is so extraordinary. This is from Michael Gwynn, White House spokesperson. Former President Trump abused the office of the presidency and attempted to subvert a peaceful transfer of power. The former president's actions represented a unique and existential threat to our democracy that can't be swept under the rug. As President Biden determined, the constitutional protections of executive privilege should not be used to shield information that reflects a clear and apparent effort to subvert the Constitution itself. White House not leaving any sort of ambiguity here about the fact that it is both the weakness of any claim of executive privilege and the grotesque nature of what the president and his inner circle did on January 6th.
Yeah, that's precisely right, Nicole. We'll just go through it here. On the first part, yes, I mean, Donald Trump is not president anymore, so therefore it's not executive privilege. And certainly, Steve Bannon was nowhere near the West Wing on January 6th. He was hosting a podcast and probably wearing a lot of shirts. But he certainly is in the Trump orbit, but not someone who that could be executive privilege, which could be applied. But the larger point is the more important one, is the idea that, yes, traditionally, presidents are pretty deferential to their predecessors when it comes to executive privilege. And maybe on other issues, shoes, this president might be too, but not in this case. The Biden administration believes, and President Biden himself personally believes, that what happened that day is, as he deemed it, is one of the darkest days in our nation's history, January 6th, and that therefore no stone should be left unturned to find out what happened, that no courtesy or favor should be given the former president or his allies in their efforts to obstruct and block the discovery of what happened that day. As more details come out, this is one of those events that as the more we learn about it, the more images we see, the more stories we hear, the more reporting that my colleagues and I have done, you are more horrified at what happened at the Capitol, yeah, but also what didn't happen at the White House and the utter lack of help and motive and urgency from then President Trump to stop. So, yes, this administration, one that, remember, ran on the very nation of trying to restore the soul of the nation and redeem America to what it once was, is certainly not going to help what they believe is the, you know, one of the darkest days, anyone who abetted one of the darkest days the nation ever seen.
It's such a good point, David Jolly, that Jonathan Lemire makes there. It's not just what we saw with our own eyes at the Capitol, but what we know we didn't see at the White House, where Mike Pence's life was in danger, yeah, at least for a while. If you watch the video, you know that his Secret Service ran him out of there. I've traveled all over with the Secret Service. They don't run their principals' places unless, yeah, they think there is a danger to them. And we don't know a whole lot about what was going on at the White House. This idea of an example, it's not making an example for punitive purposes. It's making an example about the seriousness of the investigation. I wonder if you can speak to the stakes of tonight's vote and everything that happens next.
Yeah, it's a very important premise, Nicole, because, look, I'm intimidated being on a panel with Neil Katyal and actually offering a contrasting legal thought here. But let's just presume there is a universe in which a federal court does recognize a privilege for a former president. Now, they might recognize a privilege and then say, but there's an exemption when the information is in the national interest that overrides that privilege. But let's say there is a privilege that is extended. You know, there's a lot of frustration right now in the political world that the courts might do that. There's a lot of frustration with the Democratic controlled House that somehow they are not providing the oversight necessary. That oversight is only necessary, and that privilege only obstructs the investigation if Donald Trump exercises it. And to your point, Donald Trump is not required to exercise the privilege. Steve Bannon is not required to exercise the privilege. Donald Trump and the people around him have information about the events that led to the attack on the Capitol and the near underpinning of an otherwise peaceful transfer of power following an election. Donald Trump has information that the American people deserve to know, and he is refusing to share that. And I think that is where the anger of the American people should be focused right now. That even if there is a privilege extended, it is still Donald Trump's use of that privilege that is obstructing the American people's ability to get to the bottom of what happened. We have the political tools to deal with that by never letting Donald Trump or people like him be elevated back to federal office in this case.
Well, on that note, let me read this opinion piece in the Washington Post to you, Jonathan Lemire. Trump's ludicrous January 6th lawsuit shows why we should worry about 2024. This is Greg Sargent. Let's focus on Trump's claim that the committee's requests lack any legislative purpose. That's just crazy. Here in the real world, it's easy to name numerous legitimate legislative purposes that might apply when Democrats undertake reforms of the Electoral Count Act or safeguards against presidential manipulation of law enforcement. These will immediately become associated with enemies of Trump since they smack of a response to bad things Trump did. Republicans won't associate themselves with any of that at a time when Republicans are increasingly running on an open vow to subvert future election losses and touting their support for Trump's 2020 lies as a qualification to take control over critical election machinery. That should further stoke worries about 2024. I wonder, Jonathan Lemire, if there isn't any remorse on the part of Republicans for not being for that bipartisan commission that McConnell and McCarthy sent Congressman Katko out to negotiate. Katko got everything the Republicans wanted, and then Scalise and McCarthy whipped votes against the Republican compromise, which would have given them equal subpoena power. They have now unleashed a slow-motion insurrection of future contests of 2022 and 2024. And I wonder if that brazenness Jonathan Lemire makes the stakes of 1-6 and what the White House does and what the Justice Department does in the coming days and hours and weeks all the more fraught.
Certainly, no Republican has publicly broken with the idea that there shouldn't have been a bipartisan commission. I mean, we know the few at the time who voiced support for it, not nearly enough. Privately, of course, there's long been skepticism and worry about the presence that Trump has in the Republican Party, but there's far more fear than private worry, fear as to what he would do to them, fear of his voters, fear of his what used to be his Twitter account. So there aren't Republicans standing up. And I think that the point the piece makes is right, that this is not really about 2020 anymore. Yes, Donald Trump can rage and email statements about it when he's not tweeting incredibly classless things about Colin Powell, an American military hero who just passed away. But it is about laying the groundwork going forward, about undermining the democracy further about 2022, but most particularly 2024, installing Republican, Trump-friendly Republicans as Secretary of State in battleground states. You know, we've seen the measures already by state legislatures to restrict access to the ballot. And now this claim, saying that 1-6 has the commission, had the select committee has no jurisdiction, just undermining the whole point of Congress, suggesting this is not a co-equal branch of government, that it's just executive power. And one wonders and one fears what that would mean for this president when he, if for President Trump, were he to take office again in 2024. Just a blatant disregard for the authority put up on the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue. I mean, we're in uncharted, dangerous, unfettered and unchecked territory, even more so than the last 4 years, perhaps. That's the fear. And that is the stakes here for this committee, which is why, as a final point, there are some Democrats who are angry at the and activists and liberals and progressives who are angry at the Biden administration for not doing more, not just on 1-6, but on the defend voting rights. And that's come to a head in recent days. A lot of anger that they haven't made that more of a priority because they're afraid the very democracy is at stake in the next 4 years.
I mean, David Jolly, the very democracy is at stake in the next 4 years. They're right. And I want to be thoughtful about this, but Republicans are winning. They're rigging the game. This is not about 2020. It may be on Donald Trump's couch in his pajamas with his hand in a jar of peanut butter, but in terms of the laws being passed, they've been proposed in 48 states, the primaries being run against the Brad Raffensperger's of America, against the Katie Hobbs of America. I mean, they are rigging the game for 22 and 24, and they're doing it really quickly. They're doing it really effectively, and they're doing it with almost zero Democratic resistance except for Mark Elias's lawsuits, which take a lot longer to make their way through the courts than these laws take to make their way through legislatures controlled by Republicans. And I wonder what you think the remedy is.
Yeah, Nicole, there's only two ways Republicans return to power. It's by changing hearts and minds or by stealing an election. And you can look at everything that the Republicans have done in the last year. There's not a single thing they've done to expand their coalition. There is nothing they have done to expand their coalition based on policies or politics. But what they have done is exercise the authority they have to try to create the tools going into 22 and 24 to essentially rig and steal elections, either by suppressing the opportunity for voters to get to the ballot box or by giving authority to otherwise partisan actors in elected office in some of these states that would have the ability to either decertify an election or certify a falsified election. This is being put in place for 22 and 24 as a tool to try to get Republicans to return to power. And the threat there then, certainly if we saw a Donald Trump return to power, is I'm not sure our democracy survives 4 years of Donald Trump in a second term not facing reelection. Consider already at the end of his first term, the people he had around him. There were no guardrails around Donald Trump in that last 6 months or so, and he certainly would not bring in any reputable counsel into a second term. That is why it is critical that if nothing else, if all of these tools fail of the Democratic House Oversight Committee and the 1-6 Commission, if the courts side with Donald Trump, the one tool the founders give us is for the voters to prevent someone like Donald Trump and his ilk to return to power.
Our thanks to Neil Katyal, as well as David Jolly and Jonathan Lemire for starting us off this hour. When we come back, the fight to protect American democracy in the face of what we've been talking about, an unprecedented assault by Republicans at all levels of government all across the country on the right to vote. We'll ask a top United States senator what Democrats hope to achieve when they finally vote tomorrow
on voting rights. Plus, Republicans in Texas approve a new congressional map that critics say punishes black and brown voters, the very same communities that have sparked that state's population boom in the first place. And the brewing showdown as police officers in the nation's third largest city are being placed on no-pay leave for refusing to get vaccinated. What's behind the reluctance among police officers to take the COVID vaccine? Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
The vote fundamentally is about your voice, and your voice is about your human dignity, and regardless of your faith tradition, or if you claim no faith tradition at all, it is about the preciousness of our humanity. We must pass voting rights no matter what. And while I think there are many wonderful things that hopefully will get done this Congress, I think history will judge us harshly. If in this moment, when we've seen a violent assault on our Capitol, when we've seen debate and division in our country about the state of our democracy, if the world's most important deliberative body is not willing to debate this issue, I think history will judge us harshly, and it ought to. Our children are waiting, and history is watching to see what we will do.
That was Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock, one of the architects of the Democrats' latest voting rights proposal, on MSNBC earlier today with a reminder for his colleagues in the Senate of exactly what is at stake in the fight for federal voting rights legislation. Republicans are set to filibuster Warnock's sweeping voting rights bill, which commands the support of every single Senate Democrat, but not even one Republican. Washington Post puts it like this, quote, no Republican has emerged as even being curious about supporting new federal voting legislation of the breadth that Democrats are contemplating. Joining us now, Senator Angus King of Maine. He's a member of the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees. Senator, we've covered this before. You believe the filibuster should be put aside for federal voting rights legislation. Is that still your view? And do you think that's where this is heading?
Well, when you say put aside, there are lots of options. It's not all or nothing, Nicole. There are opportunities to modify the rule, to require the opposition to be there, to require actual speaking on the floor. So I think there are some options. But I think it ought to be emphasized what we're talking about. We're being filibustered tomorrow to even bring the bill to the floor. In other words, people talk about the filibuster facilitating debate. This is the filibuster being used to stifle debate, which is really kind of ridiculous when you think about it. They're filibustering tomorrow something called the motion to proceed, which is just to bring the bill to the floor. If we have a debate on the bill and they don't like it, then there's an option to filibuster at the end of the process. But that just underlines that, you know, there's just no interest, as the Post headline you mentioned said, there's no interest in finding a solution to this. As David Jolly said, this seems to be the strategy. I always thought the way to win elections is to have better candidates and better ideas. This seems to be the way to win elections is to keep people you don't like from voting.
So you just, not that I needed it, but you just made the filibuster sound even more obstructive and heinous than I already think it is. Why are Democrats not united in filibuster reform to preserve the right to vote, to preserve the right to have votes counted? This is the Republican strategy. And I don't believe that you're actually surprised that Republicans don't want anything to do with voting rights legislation, are you?
I'm not surprised. No, I'm not surprised because there really hasn't been any outreach. You know, the compromise bill that we worked out over the summer has been around for more than a month. Nobody's come forward with a counter proposal or, hey, we could maybe do this. The reservation, Nicole, is that this is a double-edged sword. Right now, the filibuster is being used to obstruct. It could be used in the future to deconstruct important legislation, and there would be no defense. The way I put it is, today's annoying obstruction can be tomorrow's precious shield. So all of us are conscious, I certainly am, about the fact that anything we do sets the precedent that can be turned around and used against interests that those of us hold dear, whether it's voting rights, the Affordable Care Act, Social Security, Medicare, you name it. The defenses are down once we make this change. On the other hand, I've concluded that democracy itself is more important than any Senate rule. And I think that we ought to be able to find some way to satisfy those who are committed to the idea of the filibuster, bipartisanship requiring minority engagement, that we can find a path that will satisfy them, but at the same time allow us to move forward. The filibuster used to be used, you know, once every 5 years. And now it's everything. I mean, we're having to overcome filibusters on deputy secretaries of defense. Everything we do is subject to this obstruction, and it's not what the framers had in mind. The framers knew fractions. They understood they in the Constitution, there are places where they require 2/3. They debated at the founding convention about whether there should be a supermajority requirement for the passage of legislation and decided not to. And here's what's really shocking, Nicole. I did the math the other day. You can assemble 41 votes in the Senate to stop anything. And those senators, those 41 senators represent 24% of America. So 24% of Americans can basically veto anything that's important and desired by 76% of Americans. To me, that doesn't square with any theory of the way the democracy is supposed to work.
Senator, I want to push respectfully on something you said, because I think you said out loud something that senators have said to me privately, that some of the preciousness of the filibuster is this concern about how it could shield you should you be in the minority again. Do you really still believe that? Do you really think the filibuster would shield you from Mitch McConnell, 2021's Mitch McConnell, should you be in a slim minority?
Well, that's a fair question. Only, I mean, the only evidence we have is past actions. And for 4 years, President Trump hammered on Mitch McConnell to eliminate the filibuster so they could do whatever they wanted, and he didn't do it. I do think in the Republican caucus, there are those who are committed to the filibuster as an institutional principle. So, yeah, I understand that's a risk. If they take the majority in 2 years or a year or 4 years or whatever it is, it's certainly a risk that they could make that change. And that's one of the factors that has to be weighed. But Nicole, I think the discussion you had with David Jolly and Jonathan Lemire was really important, because we're talking about a fragile democracy. A representative democracy is an anomaly in world history. Most countries for thousands of years have been run by dictators, pharaohs, czars, kings, you name it. And what we have is unusual, and it's fragile. And I don't think we Americans really realize how fragile it is. And what happened last winter was a close call. If it hadn't been for a few public officials, almost all Republicans, by the way, like Raffensperger in Georgia, Mike Pence, a Republican certifier of elections in Michigan. If it hadn't been for those people, Lord knows what would have happened. We people talk lightly about a constitutional crisis. It would have been a serious crisis. We had a close call last winter, and that's why this Voting Rights Act and clarifying some of these things that are going on in the states and limiting them is so important.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, look, and I, like you, am an independent who votes for the Democrats. I have voted straight party line, not over a single policy, but over the preservation of our democracy. And I worry about your side. I worry about the Democratic Party, who right now controls the House, controls the Senate, controls the White House, and seems like a deer on a frozen pond about what to do about the filibuster when it comes to federal voting rights legislation. And I hear your conviction of purpose, but I do not hear a strategy for getting the bill through the Senate. Is there one that has consensus?
There is not one that has consensus. There is a lot of discussion going on about how could the rule be modified that would maintain the protections for the minority, and that's really what it's all about, at the same time not be a tool of just stone-cold obstruction. And there are those discussions going on. Jeff Merkley, for example, from Oregon, has done a huge amount of research about what we call the talking filibuster, just requiring people to come. You know, the most members of the public, when they hear the word filibuster, they think we're talking about Mr. Smith goes to Washington and people talking all night. That's gone now. You can phone it in. And it's just too easy. We're talking, I believe what we ought to be talking about is restoring the Senate. Restoring the Senate to what it once was, where the minority views are protected and you get bipartisanship, but not enabling, as I say, stone cold obstruction. And by the way, what's going on in these states is in no way bipartisan. I mean, it would be ironic if we failed to act here in the name of seeking bipartisanship, and you're then enabling straight up partisan actions in the states to restrict voting rights. And to, they're even talking about changing their rules so that a state legislature could override the voters of the state and send their own preferred set of electors to Washington in the Electoral College. I mean, talk about, you know, finagling the mechanics of our electoral system. That's it, you know, times 10.
Well, I mean, that is the perfect point to end on. The only people who make the Republicans in Washington look halfway decent are the Republicans out in the state. And power grab is too kind to articulate what they're doing. They're destroying democracy, one voter suppression, voter nullification bill at a time. We focus on Texas. Major League Baseball moved the All-Star game from Georgia because their bill was so bad. But you have a remedy. I mean, federal legislation usurps a lot of that. Is that on your minds? Are people fluent and concerned about what's happening out in the state, Senator, as this goes into this crucial week?
Yes. And I wish I could tell you that, you know, it's going to be A, B, C, D. I can't tell you that. And because there are members of the Democratic caucus who are very concerned, and I've been one of them, about undoing the filibuster on policy matters. But to me, this is a whole different category. And if I have to choose between democracy and a Senate rule, that's a pretty easy call, I think. And even understanding that it could come back to bite us, it could come back to bite me on something that I'm deeply concerned about in the future. But I think this issue is so transcendent mm-hmm. that it deserves a solution. Because otherwise, you know, we're sunk. This democracy is fragile and it's under attack, and it's our fundamental responsibility as members to preserve and defend the Constitution of the United States. And right now, it's in doubt.
I want to single you out for praise for your candor, for telling me where you are, not, you know, trying to make it sound like there's a plan to get from A to Z. And I would ask you to keep coming back, keep letting us know how this is going, because I agree with you. I don't know that there's anything more important than legislation to protect our democracy from what's happening out in the state. Senator Angus King, thank you so much for spending some time with us on this today.
Thank you, Nicole. Great to be with you.
When we come back, the latest move by those Republicans in Texas to decrease political representation for voters of color, the same communities that are driving the state's population growth. That story's next. It's desperate. It's dirty politics. It's morally reprehensible. It's anti-democratic. And yet, it might also be a sign of great political weakness and fear for Republican lawmakers in Texas who evidently feel they need to use every trick, and I mean trick, in the book just to maintain political power in a state that is trending blue. We have already discussed the GOP's malignant crusade on voting rights, but further proof today that their effort to put a big fat thumb on the scales of democracy goes much further than that. Last night, lawmakers in Texas approved new U.S. House maps that, according to the Associated Press, quote, favor incumbents and, surprise, decrease political representation for growing minority communities. From that AP report, quote, Republicans have said they followed the law in defending the maps, which protect their slipping grip on Texas by putting more GOP-leaning voters into suburban districts where Democrats have made inroads in recent years. The Texas GOP control both chambers of the legislature, giving them nearly complete control of the map-making process. The state has had to defend their maps in court after every redistricting process since the Voting Rights Act took effect in 1965. But this will be the first since a U.S. Supreme Court ruling said that Texas and other states with a history of racial discrimination no longer need to have the Justice Department scrutinize the maps before they are approved. Joining us now, our friend, Texas State Representative Jasmine Crockett, and our friend Basil Smigel, Democratic strategist and director of the Public Policy Program at Hunter College. Representative Crockett, we are again talking about Texas. We are again talking about anti-democratic moves by the Republicans. This feels like a big one.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, it's great to see you. Obviously, we have to talk about how crazy Texas is and how racist Texas is. Yeah, it's a constant down this way. It's really sad, though, because, you know, just like I kept saying that they only wanted our bodies in the state house so that they could bulldoze us. They only wanted all of these people to move to the state of Texas so that they could then increase their power. They completely ignored the numbers. And it was really sad to hear the bill author consistently say, I'm not advised. I'm not advised. I'm not advised. And to think that there's only 150 people in the House to represent almost 30 million people. And we're entrusted with writing the laws. And the very person that is the bill author for redistricting, which is done once every 10 years, who's been the chairman of redistricting now for a second time, is telling us that he's unadvised about the numbers and about, you know, what's happening in these districts. It's just deplorable and it's inexcusable. And I think that we've got to do everything that we can to vote as many of these people out. But unlike the president, I don't think that we can out-organize bad policy.
Yeah, I mean, look, Basil, I understand the structural limitations. I was pushing Senator Angus King on that, and he was pretty candid about where the caucus is. But the notion that you can out-organize nullification of votes, nullification of citizens, is faulty on its face. I want to read some more from this AP reporting about the lawsuits, but I just want to start by saying that I am concerned that y'all don't have time for lawsuits to wind their way through the court. So let me read this. We'll talk about it on the other side. Civil rights groups, including the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund, sued before Republican lawmakers were even done on Monday. The lawsuit alleges that Republican mapmakers diluted the political strength of minority voters by not drawing any new districts where Latino residents hold a majority, despite Latinos making up half of Texas's 4 million new residents over the last decade. The plan does not create any additional districts where Black or Hispanic voters make up more than 50% of the voting population, even as people of color accounted for more than 9 of 10 new residents in Texas over the past decade. Where do you go from here?
It's incredible when you think about some of the structural problems to getting this to change. I mean, we don't have nationally any one way to redistrict our states. It's as fragmented as voting is across the country. And when you think about the Supreme Court cases, there were two in the last year that in the last 8 years, excuse me, that ripped the guts out of the Voting Rights Act. So we have Republicans saying we don't need to go back to the court. We know exactly what the court says, and we're operating within those rules, which of course is done in a pernicious manner. You're right to suggest and point out that that Democrats or activists that are really concerned about this may not have the time to take these matters to court. And we should be organizing. We should be doing more. We see evidence of that. But we've also seen this coming. We've lost mm-hmm. seats through the Rust Belt, and they're being gained in other places like Texas, Florida, North Carolina. We've saw this coming. And why we haven't done more, and there are individuals, certainly my friend Cliff Albright, Black Votes Matter in Georgia and other groups like that, they're mobilized. But we need to be doing so much more legislatively and on the ground
in anticipation of what's to come. We saw back in the early 2000s, Democrats get redistricting out of the Midwest. We've seen how Democrats are now in the suburbs in ways that they weren't previously, which is why you had Donald Trump talking about the suburbs in the way that he did towards the election in 2020. And you see now Republicans trying to make inroads in urban areas because of gentrification. So as these demographic shifts are taking place, we have to be just as nimble, just as agile to sort of beat them to the punch because they're drawing lines around us to restrict and curtail our power. And we just can't continue to let that happen.
Representative Crockett, you and your colleagues now famously came to Washington to ask for help. Do you feel like those pleas landed on deaf ears? Or, I mean, are you going to pick up the phone and call again for help on this front?
I think that we rang the alarms, right? And I don't know if they recognized, as it's been stated, that this is something we saw coming, right? But we rang the alarms to the extent that even the general public became aware that we are in a point in which we don't know where democracy is going. And we should never have a question about that in the United States of America. But after ringing the alarms, we saw some action on behalf of the House. The Senate has continually let us down. And this idea that we're still debating, well, how do we go about the filibuster? I don't really think that there is a debate. I think that we have to just say that we are going to do whatever it takes because democracy is on the line. This isn't one simple policy issue. This is the policy issue that actually has the ability to shape policy in the entire country. And so this idea that we're still like, well, we don't know what to do. We think that we can do something, maybe. We don't have time for that. Right now, we know that not just the Texas legislature, but the legislatures in Arizona, the legislature in Florida, the legislatures throughout this country are really tearing down our very democracy and what we know of it. And we've got two people really that are sitting in D.C. that are saying, nope, we won't do anything. And when you think about the numbers, when you think about how many people they don't represent, right? We know that we did everything that we can. When we talk about organizing, he talks about Cliff Albright. We talked about Black Voters Matter. We know what happened in Georgia, and we know that there was backlash because of the hard work that was done in Georgia. We know that there was backlash in Texas because only managed to win the state of Texas by 5 points. That is unheard of. And if you start to lose Texas, then you will never get the White House back. And Texas understands that, and that's why we had to endure this power grab.
Yeah, it is like a mad, frantic power grab. Their fear is showing. Texas State Representative Jasmine Crockett, it might be time for you to head to Washington again. And Basil Michael, our good friend, thank you both for spending some time with us. When we come back, what's behind the reluctance among so many police officers about getting vaccinated? It's a question a growing number of cities across the country are grappling with. We'll be back with that story after a short break. Major showdowns over COVID vaccine mandates across the country are coming to a head this week. In Chicago, 1,300 officers told the city they have not been vaccinated. Another 4,500, or about one-third of the force, has not submitted their vaccine status as required by the mayor's mandate for all city employees since Friday, putting their pay in jeopardy. Let's bring into our coverage Cedric Alexander, former member of President Obama's Task Force on 21st Century Policing and a former public safety director in DeKalb County, Georgia. Tell me what's going on. Is this resistance to getting the shot or resistance to being mandated to get the shot, or both?
Well, it may be a combination of a number of things, but let's think about it this way. Our police officers are just a microcosm of a larger society in which we live in. We know that there are people out there across this country who are not, or who choose not to get vaccinated. They come in all professions. These just happen to be police officers. But I think it's important to understand that many of these police officers understand the risk that they're taking if they choose not to get vaccinated. They know they're in the public. They meet people. They're talking to people. They're engaging in conversations. And if they choose not to get vaccinated, that's the risk that they're choosing to take. Now, here's the thing they also have to take into account. When cars with their other officers, or they go home and they're with their family, their friends, their loved ones, if they're taking all these things into account, they choose not to get vaccinated, then the question becomes, do they have the right to not take it? And I think it's no different than any other part of the population in this country that are choosing not to get vaccinated. I myself vaccinated. Most police officers I know across this country vaccinated. But you're always going to have a certain segment or population, even within Chicago PD and others, that may choose to do otherwise. So this is going to be an ongoing issue and debate. And I think over time they will resolve this. But everyone is going to have to take individual responsibility for themselves and do what they feel is best for themselves. But if this is going to be a case that's going to be, these are going to be cases that are going to certainly be challenged on both sides. And hopefully they find some resolve around them.
And COVID-19 is now the leading cause of death for police officers in America. Not gunshots, not anything else. With your help, we'll stay on it because I'd really like to understand how it gets resolved. Cedric Alexander, thank you so much for being part of it. Thank you so much for being part of it. To be continued. A quick break for us. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're grateful.